You are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Brian Schwartz. This is another exciting episode of Tech Reads, the podcast sponsored by Softech here in San Luis Obispo. And I'm very pleased today because we've got Captain George Dom with us. George just published a book called High Trust Leadership, and he's going to talk a little bit about that today, but I'm also going to ask him some questions about his personal life. He will be featured in an upcoming issue of Slow Life magazine. In fact, the next issue in a couple months it comes out. So we're going to be taking this interview so you guys get a little bit of an early preview of it. So anyway, it's an honor. George, you have an impressive career as a former Blue Angel, and now you are, after being, what, COO of ACI Jet for many years?
Yep.
Is it February you're officially retiring from here?
No, I stepped down as COO in April, but I'm still flying 10 days a month in one of the corporate jets out here.
And now come February.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see what the FAA says.
So you're getting to that age where it's time to stop flying.
I'm trying to play it as long as I can.
And this doesn't mean you're going to stop flying, though.
No, I'm lucky enough to share an airplane with a couple other guys, so I get to keep flying and maybe actually get back into. A few years ago, I got my glider rating, and so I'm looking forward to getting back into that.
That's very impressive. So, stepping way back in the beginning, and I'll give you guys opportunities to ask questions as well, but I have a few here. So, you spent 26 years with the Navy. What prompted you to initially enlist?
Well, you know, as Bob was in the Army in the 70s, I grew up in high school in the 70s, and of course, in those days, being in the military was not at the top of a lot of young people's list of things to do, but my father had served in the Navy in World War II, and I was the youngest of three boys, and I knew that having one of his sons have a military experience was important to him. And so both my brothers gave it to Heisman, and so it came down to me, and I applied for an ROTC scholarship and was accepted and went off to college and into the Navy. Best decision I ever made.
And was your goal to actually be a pilot from day one?
No, actually my plan was to, you don't have to commit to serve until the beginning of your junior year. And so my plan was to do it for 2 years and then drop out.
Check it off the list.
And then tell my dad that, hey, I tried it, it wasn't for me. And he would have been disappointed, but he would have understood. But man, in the summertime you get a chance to go on active duty and experience different things. And so the summer between my sophomore and junior year, I spent a week on a destroyer, a week on a submarine, a couple weeks with the Marine Corps, and a couple weeks in aviation. And I got the back seat of a TA-4 Skyhawk jet, and I said, I think I'm going to try this and see what happens.
That's all it took. You were hooked. So how did your 26-year career prepare you for the private sector? Because you've had a successful transition into, is that safe to say?
Well, I'd like to think so, okay. Yeah. you know, it's funny, people's perception of what military life is like and so forth. I mean, I've had people say to me when I've given talks and so forth afterwards, say to me, come on, how tough could it have been to be a leader in the military? You give people orders and they do what you tell them. Or people think the military is just very, very regimented, both in the way we operate as well as, you know, in our thinking. And frankly, I'll tell you that some of the most nuanced, critical thinkers have been military folks that I've worked with. I mean, I did a tour in the Pentagon, and meeting folks that had served overseas, like during the Operation Iraqi Freedom, or afterwards, you had young Army captains who were literally mayors of cities trying to figure out, you know, how to make this work. So the military experience is an exceptional experience for leadership anywhere, whether it's in business or nonprofit or wherever. And there's nothing, you know, it's pretty common sense, right? You just learn how to identify what is the mission and then organize around that and then take care of the people that are involved and give them the opportunity to go out and execute and then recognize them and so forth. So it was very, very translatable from one to the other.
So what are some of the key distinctions that you've witnessed in others and experienced yourself firsthand to achieving like high levels of success? Like, you're sort of at this elite level, especially if you make it to the Blue Angels. Are there some common threads that you sort of witnessed or had to muster up yourself to sort of, because I understand as you break to higher levels of success, it becomes harder to sustain that, and even you're even working harder to stay up there. Is that true?
Well, are you talking about personally or organizationally?
Both.
Okay. Well, organizationally, some of you were in Morro Bay when I talked about my book, High Trust Leadership, and that in my view is probably a keystone leadership skill, is to be able to earn the level of trust among the people that you're working with, as well as help them develop a culture of really high trust. Because out of that just comes tremendous productivity, agility, innovation, and resilience too. So, you know, that was something, and once I experienced that in the military, then everywhere I went, I was trying to develop that same culture. And that's what I try to describe in the book. You know, how did we go about building and maintaining that? And for the listeners, I'll just go over very quickly. There were five things that I had to pay attention to in order to earn unconditional trust of my wing. And for example, the 2 years I flew with the Blue Angels, I literally, these guys were coming to work 6 days a week for 2 years and putting their life in my hands every day, because we're flying 2 feet apart at 300, 400, 500 miles an hour, doing three-dimensional formation aerobatics at very low altitude. And and I didn't quite have it all figured out at the beginning, but when I look back on that experience, there were these five areas I had to pay attention to, and I had to pay attention to all five. If I dropped one out, then at some point an issue was going to arise that we would have to address. But if you pay attention to one, it reinforces the other four. So you get this upward spiral of trust and confidence and higher performance. So, and for each one, there were questions that my team was asking about me, and depending upon the answers they discerned to those questions, they would make a judgment to what degree they were going to trust me. And I believe these are the same five questions that folks in your life, on your teams, are asking about you and making judgments based on the answers they discern. So very quickly, the first one related to my character, and the question was simply, do you walk your talk? Do you live up to your obligations, keep your promises? Are you honest? And so forth. Do you live our shared values? And in the Navy and Marine Corps, we had three core values: honor, courage, and commitment. And my team was judging me based on that, as well as the certain standards that we had as a team, right? Was I gonna live up to those standards that we had set for ourselves, which, as you might imagine, with the Blue Angels, pretty high standards to live up to. The second one was commitment. My team was absolutely certain that I was going to show up to lead them on a sunny day when the sky was blue and the air was smooth, but they knew that literally and figuratively we were going to go through some storms together, because that's the way life is. Either you're in a storm now, or you just came out of a storm, or guess what, you're getting ready to go into the next one. And what they wanted to know was, are you going to be with us when the going gets tough? When we have to take a punch, not only are you gonna show up, but are you gonna show up and bring your A game and be the best leader you can be to help us get through this to victory on the other side? And because if you're just showing up to take names or cast blame or CYA, forget about it. And then the next one is competence. this is the one we mostly think about when we're making a trust decision, either in hiring or promotion or rewards or what have you, recognition. We think about how good is this person in the work. And of course, that's absolutely important. But I put it third for a reason, because I believe if you don't get the first two, the third one doesn't matter so much, right? And if you can get the first two, if somebody walks our talk and is all in and they have a reasonable amount of experience and talent, you can pretty much teach them what they need to know in order to perform well as a teammate. So every day I'd show up for the pre-flight briefing around a conference table like this. I'd be sitting at the head of the table and my wingman and the other officers are around the room, and I'd look around and I could see the third question in their eyes. And the question was, are you good enough to be our leader today? Are you better than you were yesterday, but not as good as you're going to be tomorrow? Because we don't want to stay here. We want to keep getting better and better. And by definition, you as our leader need to keep getting better and better. So there was always great pressure on me to keep improving. And we can talk more about that, because we had an interesting process that we did that was really critical for individual and organizational improvement every single day. Then the fourth one is the one I think most leaders are missing in this Mach 2 world that we live in, where we all have to-do lists a mile long and we're just trying to just go as quickly as we can. And this one relates to what I call connection. You see, by the middle of the air show season, our team had gotten so connected that, you see, when you're flying that close together, I didn't move either hand, either on the control stick or on the throttles, without first giving my wingman a command, a preparation, and then execution. And that way, we would all move the controls together, and then we would fly as one, right? And by the middle of the season, I could change the trajectory of a maneuver simply by the inflection of my voice on the radios. Not the words I said, but how I said the words. For example, if we were doing a looping maneuver and we're coming down the bottom of the loop, and I'm gonna say, comes the pull. Now, when I say comes the, they know it's coming. When I say comes the pull, they know it's coming. And then when I say the P and pull, we all pull back on the sticks together. And because we've done this hundreds of times, they know exactly how hard to pull in order to match me as we get to the bottom of the loop. But if there's a ridge line or a bridge or something, and I need to pull harder at the bottom to make sure that we keep a safe separation, then I would say, comes the pull. And they all know, okay, we're going to pull harder on this one. And so I could speed the rolls to keep us under clouds. I could tighten the formation turn around the skyscraper. And I could do all of that because my wingmen, they believed, they knew that I understood what I was asking them to do out there. But if for a minute they doubted that I got them, that I understood the challenges that they were facing, then all of a sudden that's where you get the hesitation, the separation, and the disengagement, right? So the question is, for me, was, do they believe I understand them? Which is a different question than, do I believe I understand them? Because what I believe is interesting, but not sufficient. What matters is, what do they believe? And when you invest in the relationships to the point that they believe that you get them, that you understand their challenges, their hopes, their concerns, and that you are taking them into account whenever you're making a decision, then they join up and come along. See, I believe people don't need to get their way all the time, but they do need to be sure that they feel heard, that they're understood. And when they feel understood, they're gonna come along. Then the final one was communication. And so if connection is, do they believe I understand them, then communication is, do they understand me? Am I transmitting in a way that is clear, concise, direct, and consistent such that they get the message that I'm transmitting. Because in this world today, we are being bombarded by input all the time. And to be able to cut through all of that and get the message out there that they then receive can be a bit of a challenge. And what I find is for leaders, the challenge with communication is the presumption that it's occurred, right? I sent the email, he gets it. I gave the talk, they get it. I had the one-on-one, she gets it. They don't get it, at least not right away, right? You have to keep transmitting in a consistent way until the message gets received. I mean, think about how many times you have to hear a new song before you get the lyrics. And too often, we presume that the communication has occurred, and we don't do like we do in aviation, where we make sure that there's no misunderstanding, because we verify the receiver has to repeat back to the transmitter what they heard, so we make sure there's no misunderstanding. We need to do that as well in our routine communications to make sure that the listener got the message that we intended.
Yeah, I call that a one-sided promise. Like, I had a promise with someone, but they didn't reciprocate.
Yeah.
And it usually leads to a lot of issues. Like, would you say of those five, is there one area that people are most, like, even you struggled at the most as you developed?
Well, I think, you know, a couple things. One is, we're always struggling to do the right thing all the time as best we can. And the challenge with that is sometimes you think you're doing everything right, but you don't know how you're being perceived by the rest of the audience, right? The teammate, particularly whenever the group gets large, right? So you have to have truth tellers out there, people that you trust that you can go to, who will tell you the truth about how you're coming across. Because, like, I tell a story, it's funny. When my younger daughter was about 5 years old, she was everything Disney. And she would say almost on a daily basis, "Dad, can we go to Disney? I really want to go to Disney World." And of course, I wanted to give her that lifelong experience of the Magic Kingdom, right? So I would say, "Hey, you bet. We're going to Disney World, you bet." And then finally, my wife, who's my consummate truth teller, she says to me, "Now, when are we going to Disney?" And I say, "Well, you know, maybe after, you know, maybe in the springtime or wherever." And she said, "Look, your daughter operates on about a 2-week horizon. So every 2 weeks it goes by that we're not going to Disney is a broken promise. You get that, don't you?" So, you know, we think we're often doing the right thing, but you just never know how it's coming across. So that's the challenge with character. Commitment, that, you know, people say, where does commitment come from? You know, there's organizations out there, like, you know, a few years back at the end of the Boston Marathon, you got two bombs detonate, and there's people that are so committed to serving others, these first responders and police and so forth, that instead of turning and running away from the blast, they instinctively turn and run towards the blast. Now, where does that kind of commitment come from? And I believe commitment comes from a very deep, a very clear, and a very intense sense of purpose. In the military, we call it mission. And when you know what mission you're on and why it's really important, then that's what gets you up off the ground, you get knocked down, or that you power through the storm to hang in there. And so the challenge is, first of all, being very clear about your purpose and why it's important, but then helping the people that you work with figure out a little bit about what are they trying to accomplish. And when you can get them to see what their purpose is, and why working with you is going to help them along the way to get where they want to get to, you don't have to motivate people. You just have to train them and give them the resourcing and the guidance and wisdom of your experience, and then get out of the way, because they are just going to be getting after it. But I think connection is probably our biggest challenge as a society right now. You know, Stephen Covey has a great quote. He says, You can be efficient with things, but you can't be efficient with people. And we've got all this stuff, you know, 10 ways to do this, the top 6 things to do here. We all want a checklist or hacks that help us get a shortcut to getting the outcome that we want. And there is no shortcut with people. You have to take the time to invest in the relationship so that you can make that connection, so that they feel understood and they believe that you understand them. And then, of course, the same thing with communication. I mean, oh my gosh, getting through all the noise that's out there. So I'm naming all 5, Brian, to answer your question.
So the humility piece too, though, because I suspect that's kind of wrapped into all that, because if you start coming up with an ego, you start to lose the support of your team, right?
Yeah, and I'd be interested to hear what other folks' experience was, but you know, the experience I had in the military was, now we had some big egos, don't get me wrong. We had some people that thought pretty highly of themselves, but the culture was, if you were a self-promoter, stand by, you're gonna get cut down to size here at some point, right? So the culture of naval aviation is you let your actions speak for yourself, but you don't get too full of yourself. And coming from a family of women with 2 daughters, I keep grounded pretty well every day by them. And also I would say that, you know, when you're part of organizations of really, really great people, very talented, very motivated, I mean, for me, I was just always trying to keep up, to get better, to, you know, and when you have that sort of mindset, then it keeps you from sort of getting carried away. So.
All right, my last kind of key question, and then I'll open it up to others, was, can you share your life philosophy and how it has changed over the years? Like, what might it say on your tombstone? To sort of sum up, have you been consistent with your life philosophy? Like, where, I just am curious, because you seem to be pretty solid with the way you view the world, despite what's going on around you.
Yeah, so, my dedication in my book was to my father. Here was a guy who grew up, he had 6 sisters, imagine that, 6 sisters, no brothers, and he was in the middle. He had 3 older and 3 younger. You know, World War II came along, and he wanted to volunteer to serve, and he got turned down several times. Partly, I don't know exactly, but partly was probably because of his family situation. His father had passed away, so he was the only male in the family, but also because he was older. He was, I want to say he was at least late 20s, early 30s. He'd been to law school and so forth. It took him like 3 tries to volunteer before he finally got accepted, and then he commanded an amphibious ship, went over to the Mediterranean, was involved in amphibious landings in Africa and in Italy, and then he came home, and then he volunteered to go out to the Pacific, and he led a flotilla of amphibious ships as they did the island hopping out in the Pacific. And I said to him one day, I said, why did you do that? I mean, you did your part over in the Med, then you came home and you went out to the Pacific. You know, why did you do that? And he said, well, I just never wanted anybody to be able to say I didn't do my part. And he had a tremendous sense of honor and integrity and so forth that he passed on to my brothers and I. And so I would say that's really sort of the common thread, right, is service and all of that.
So service above self.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm so grateful for that I took his advice and signed up to serve, because it was such an extraordinary experience to be on an aircraft carrier for 8 months at a time with 4,999 of your shipmates coming from all walks of life across this country, from all ethnicities, all religions, all classes, all backgrounds, come together under a common mission and shared sacrifice. And the morale is just really good. You may not know everybody, but you see them on the hangar bay or walking down the passageway, and people say hello to each other because there's this feeling that we're all in this together.
Real special.
Yeah.
And what were your role? And you did over 1,000 aircraft carrier landings.
1,023.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. 400 some at night, which that's where you earn your pay.
And
daytime, it's a great sport.
And this wasn't like rehearsal stuff. This was actually in active duty.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's no rehearsal. You can't rehearse taking off and landing of an aircraft. You can practice at the field. And my first duty station was over here at Navy Lemoore near Fresno. And, you know, before you go out the first time, you turn off the runway lights and they light up the little carrier box there. And you do this at night so that you don't have the visual references of the ground or everything. And so you got a fly instrument. Because over the water, you can't really tell how high you are just by looking at it. So you got to use an instrument scan around the pattern to roll out and then get in the hit the glide slope and come down and land. But the first time you get a catapult shot where you go from sitting still to 185 miles an hour in about 3 seconds, you can't simulate that anywhere else. So the first time you do it, you do it. And the same thing with landing, right? The flow of wind over the deck and the deck motion and all of that is unique. You can't replicate
it. No mishaps after all those?
No, I was lucky. I never had to jump out of an airplane. I got pretty close one time, but no, I never had to. Thankfully, I was pretty lucky.
Yeah. But back to the active duty question, you were literally in, like, this is during bombings and things that were happening in Iraq, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first combat operations I was in was in Libya back in 1986, which some of you may remember. And then that was when we struck a really little-known military base near a city that was nobody had ever heard of, but now is really famous, called Benghazi. And then after Libya, then Desert Storm, and then after Desert Storm, we were defending the no-fly zone over southern Iraq, and they were shooting at us every day, and we were, I don't know, they had up in the command center, they had some scoreboard. They shoot at us three or four times, and then we go bomb them, and then it was a cat and mouse kind of thing. And then during the Kosovo, Serbian, up in the Adriatic. So that's the cool thing about the Navy is, you know, when you're on a carrier, you're out there and something flares up, the first thing they say is, okay, where's the nearest carrier? Let's get them there to show presence or go to work if necessary.
Wow, wow, pretty impressive. What questions have come up for anyone else that you want to ask? Eric.
I imagine people always think that Blue Angels was the pinnacle of your career just because of the spectacle of it, the fame of it, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you see as the pinnacle of your career.
Well, it was clearly it was truly memorable, and the opportunity to be able to go out and tell the American public the story of, you know, the hundreds of thousands of men and women out there serving every day was really, really special. And the opportunity to find out how good could I get in a jet? You know, the whole organization is just focused to how do we get as good as we possibly be. But I would have to say that my last operational tour was the Air Wing Commander on the Eisenhower and the John F. Kennedy. And so to be able to take what I had learned along the way and then lead 9 squadrons on the aircraft carrier was really, really special. Yeah.
And do those things follow through? The kind of Blue Angels experience to that leading?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly the ability to focus, the ability to never be quite satisfied, always trying to get better every day. But a lot of it was personal development, you know, because with the Blues, you could never afford to have a bad day. Some days could be better than others, but man, when the canopies came down, if you were distracted or pissed off or discouraged or whatever, you just couldn't have it, right? So you had to be absolutely in the moment, fully focused with a full bag of energy in order to be able to perform at that level every day. And so that was the big challenge, was how do you do that day in and day out for 2 years? Yeah.
Did you have to like turn off your emotions? You can't get emotional up there.
You had to control your emotions. You can't turn them off. But we had certain rituals, some things. I'll give you an example. About roughly 6 years or so before I took over the team as the leader, we had a situation where one of the wingmen, you know, was trying. This is really hard to do. The flying is really challenging, and there was a maneuver that Blue Angel number two pilot was struggling with, and every day he was just having a problem with this one maneuver. And so, as you at one point, you could hear on the radios whenever he would come up and talk on the radios occasionally, and they would do the maneuver, and then they would stop. Well, not stop, but they would move out and then fly along and talk about it, debrief it, and then they would do it again. And then they would talk about it and do it again. And you could hear in his voice that he was getting frustrated because he just wasn't quite getting it. And of course, he feels a lot of pressure on himself, and he's got these other guys out there, come on, dude. You know, they're not saying that, but he knows that that's sort of what they're thinking, right? And then on the next try, he hit the leader. And he ends up jumping out of the airplane, and the leader gets his airplane, even though it's damaged, gets it back to the airfield and gets it and lands it. And so after that, the rule was, you cannot show your frustrations on the radio. You have to be upbeat and positive. You cannot. And it goes back to the age-old thing: do emotions affect behavior? Or does behavior affect emotions? And the answer is, it's both. And so I remember, okay, I show up and I find out, okay, this is one of our standards. You don't show emotions on the radio. All right? And so we're out practicing and I screw up a maneuver. And I'm frustrated with myself and so forth, and we go behind to set up the next maneuver, and I know everybody's wondering, okay, what's this gonna sound like? And so, you know, okay. So I came up on the radios in a very positive thing and said, okay, we're behind the crowd setting up the line of breast loop. And it was amazing how that changed my attitude. That behavior changed my emotions, where I was able to flush that mistake and think about the next maneuver. And it's, you hear about that in sports, right? Next play. Forget about what just happened.
So. Perfect. Tom.
This is probably more just of a comment, but I'm just kind of really in awe when I think about what you're doing, but I also think about, like, I'm looking at this jet.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the aircraft carrier and 5,000 people you said on that.
Yeah.
The teamwork from the, whether the guy cleaning or whatever, everything has to work perfect. I mean, when you're flying, you're trusting the guy putting air in the tire.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about trust.
Yep.
I mean,
it's unbelievable.
Every day when you're flying an airplane, I think of that. My father was a pilot, and father-in-law was a pilot.
Yep.
It's just, so it's amazing. I just.
Yeah. And you would, you know, you'd be out there, and it would be bad weather. There's something wrong with the airplane, there's something wrong with the ship's moving, so forth, and everybody's getting low on gas. And you just have to, okay, I'm gonna do my job as well as I possibly can and hope everybody else is doing their job and this is all gonna work out. And most of the vast majority of the times it does. It's very cool. And the other comment, sorry, it just sort of synapse just fired in my brain. But one of the sayings that we had, you know, you hear things like, yeah, you know, people rise to the occasion, right? We didn't believe that. Well, we believe that you don't rise to the occasion, you fall to your training. And so we would, you know, the saying is, you know, you train hard and fight easy. And so we would really train hard as realistically as we possibly could for my neighbors up in Cambria that are cranky about the jet noise sometimes. But those are folks that are out there trying to, you know, get as good as they can be so when the shooting starts, you know, they're equipped to go out and handle, you know, whatever comes out. And my experience after Desert Storm was, because as it just happened, depending upon who was where at the time, half the aircraft carriers played in Desert Storm, and the other half, because they were in a different portion in their cycle, didn't get to play. And so I would meet up with a friend of mine somewhere at an officer's club somewhere afterwards who didn't get to play, and he would be asking about, you know, what it was like. And I know in the back of his mind, he was asking because he's wondering, how would I have done if I had been out there getting shot at and so forth? And, you know, it was great to be able to tell him that, you know, compared to what the training that we do in Nevada before we go on deployment, other than being shot at, the missions themselves were actually pretty easy. But so, you know, we really did it right. And that's why, you know, the U.S. military tends to be pretty darn effective. It's because we train better than anybody in the world. So.
Go ahead, Brian.
Do you make a distinction in trust between people, like your wingmen, the 100 and something people that you know directly, and the institution, the other 4,900 and something people on the ship?
Well, you know, there were people that I had direct contact with, right, that I had relationships and professional, may not have been, like, for example, you land on the aircraft carrier at night, and the only thing that's lit is the landing area, right? And you're coming into this little postage stamp in the middle of the ocean, and then you land, but because they need to make sure that everybody's night vision and everything is okay, the first thing you do when you land and you catch the tailhook and you have this controlled crash where you just come to a stop from 135 miles an hour to stop in a couple hundred feet, first thing you do is turn off your lights, fold your wings, raise the tailhook, and then out here in front of you comes a 22-year-old taxi director, and he's, and all you can see are these yellow wands that he has, and he starts taxiing you forward, and you got to get your wings folded and get out of the landing area because your wingman's a minute behind you. We try to land every minute at night, and so you clear the landing area so he can come in and land, and so that taxi director passes you off to somebody else who passes you off to, next thing you know, you're taxiing up the bow of the ship. And to get you around the catapult track and back where they want you to park, because the nose gear of the F-18 is behind the cockpit, you're out over the water as you're making this turn in the dark, and all you see are these wands, and this guy's telling you to hold your brakes, come on. And early on in the training, you reach a point where you go, that's as far as I'm going. Yeah. But then you get to where there were guys, I would do anything because I knew they had their act together. And so I don't know if that answered your question or not, but it was pretty cool. But I think one of the things we're suffering from right now is we're losing trust in a lot of our institutions and so forth. And we're going to have to figure out how do we regain that trust, because, you know, there's trust individually, but then there's trust organizationally. And you may have a whole bunch of people in the organization who are trustworthy, but if the organization behaves in a way that's not, like AT&T, right? The people I meet from AT&T are individually are some of the most wonderful people. They're trying to be helpful and so forth. But the organization, holy crap, if I hear one more time as I'm on hold for 45 minutes that they appreciate my that I'm a customer, I'll scream, right? Or they have their website, you can't decipher what is a good deal, what's a not, how does this all work? And of course, they seem to be more interested in new customers than they do in loyal customers, right? So we as leaders have to think about not only ourselves and our team, but also the organization. How's the organization behaving within those five areas? Please.
How did you transition from military to commercial and like develop some of those business skills? How was that transition?
You know, there were some things, of course, I had to learn because of different cultures, right? But I think the fundamentals were the same. So I don't think it was that hard. A lot of it was just trying to understand where people were coming from that hadn't. I mean, that's all I knew up until then from college on, right? And so just trying to understand the differences in the culture and this making sure that I was that they I was relatable and that they understood. So it's a two-way street, of course, but...
Was there friction, though, coming from that sort of very institutionalized or at least rigid vetting and, like you said, disciplinary action in the military is different than in the real world, you know, in the private sector? Was there initially some adjustment you had to make?
Some, but not as much as you think, because, again, I think the stereotype is really incorrect. Now, there are some military organizations, particularly in the infantry and in some places, are a bit more. But in aviation, because we had to build trust, and trust is all about relationships, right? So you had to be able to develop those. So I think coming, for at least from my background, it wasn't that tough. But, and of course, within that, you have all kinds of personalities, right? I mean, we had some shitheads, you know, that as well. We're not perfect by any means. So.
Related to his question, what about the demographics when you went commercial? Because it's a different type of person that buys and sells their planes.
Oh, yeah, you mean the clients that we have? Yeah, well, I'm not sure that that's a military commercial piece. I think that's a class thing, right? Where, but I found that, you know, the high net worth people that that we have as clients and customers are, they're not all the same. There's a lot of variability, you know. Some of them are, boy, like take a guy like, you know, Warren Buffett is about as down to earth as you can be, right? And
you flown for Warren?
No.
No.
I'm just using that as an example. You know, his whole deal is that, you know, he strives to be able to have relationships such that he can do a deal on a handshake, right? But then you have others who completely lose their sense of grounding and all of that, right? We say there's two things that reflect people's character, right? Money and alcohol. So you have the whole gamut, of course, and you know there are some that are just really high maintenance, and the some of the things that they think are important or that they're entitled to are just off the page. So
I've asked you about this before, but the dopamine that you must have experienced as a pilot, as a Blue Angel especially, like, do you find that you seek out more risky activities because you're getting that rush of dopamine, or is that kind of a misnomer?
I wouldn't say seeking out risky stuff, but, you know, and there's a lot of science behind this, the whole idea of being in flow, right, where you lose your sense of time, you're totally in the moment, whatever activity you're doing, and that is across the spectrum. I mean, I really enjoy flying these little nine-seat corporate jets out here, the Citation XLS, because any time that you have a situation where you are skilled enough to be confident, but there's still you're doing something that challenges you to perform at your best, or maybe actually we'll see how this goes kind of thing. You know, that I think I do seek out that kind of experience. Otherwise, you feel like you're kind of getting flabby, right? So that's why, you know, when I stop flying here, I'm looking forward to getting into gliding again, because the idea of going out for a couple hours flying an airplane that doesn't have an engine, you know, that's challenging all the time. You got to always be thinking. It's like, you know, but five-dimensional chess.
You don't paraglide or do any other kind of crazy...
I don't do that. Because you start out your career with nine lives. By the time you get to be my age, you've used up eight of them. So now you're just trying to micromanage that last one. So there's some things I don't do anymore because...
That makes sense.
Statistically, I'm due.
You're grateful you've made it this far.
That's right.
And your luck is running out.
Where do you glide? Where do you fly out of?
I learned up in Truckee.
Okay.
Which is cool, but they do some flying at Hollister up the road, and over between here and Fresno, there's another one. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. But there's glider stuff all over the place.
Yeah, when you brought that up, I had totally forgotten about gliders. Like, we used to see them more when I was younger, it seemed like you could see gliders, but it's such a rare sight now. Is that just because I don't see them, or okay, they're still there and still popular?
Yeah. Huh. Oh yeah.
Back in another life, my stepfather was a competitive glider pilot, and he would compete with people from all over the world. And this is when I was probably 14, 15 years old. I was crewing for him down the Mojave Desert. We'd go down there. But just the whole experience of the cumulus clouds and flying from station to station, I'd fall around on the trail in case you had to land out.
Yeah.
Which only happened one time out of all the times I did that, but that's like a total different world. But just the whole quiet, no engine. He was a commercial airline pilot.
Yeah,
also.
And there's no stigma if you do an off-field landing, right? Because they say, if you haven't, you will. So there's absolutely no stigma. At some point, you get to where you can't find any more lift. And the first line of the glider handbook is, just remember, in a glider, you're always descending. You're always coming down, right? You just hope to find air mass that's rising faster than you're coming down. But you're always coming down. And at some point, you get to an altitude where you go, okay, I got to stop looking for lift. I just need to find a safe space, safe field or something to put this thing down
somewhere.
In.
Yeah.
And can you bail out of that if you need to with the parachute?
You have a parachute, but the reason that you would need it, it's not like, okay, if I lose the engine, I'm going to jump out, because you don't have an engine, right? So it could be if you had a midair with somebody else and you couldn't control the airplane. But now the thing's going to be moving pretty violently if you damage your wing or something. So you wear a parachute, but it would be challenging.
Oh, I got a good one. What do you think is all these drone sightings that they're happening over all these America's like precious resources that the government seems to be clueless about? Do you have any insight?
And Vandenberg Space Force Base.
I mean, what? Really? How can we not be on top of these gigantic drones? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I haven't seen. How big are they talking
They're
about?
As big as small SUVs, they said. These are gigantic drones.
Yeah.
Like military size, I would assume.
Well, it's because the FAA won't let you shoot them down. Like, it's not that we can't, it's that we're not allowed to.
Yeah, here's a guy that builds drones.
Okay.
Yeah, like we have.
So you're the drone builder, then. Yeah.
So you probably have a theory.
Why are you flying your drones around?
Why are these guys all got in line together and said, let's tick off the government and everybody else?
I mean, set us to ease, because I'm getting a little nervous, like a lot of the rest of Americans.
Yeah, I haven't looked that much into it, but like, sure, you can't legally shoot it down, but like, can't you follow it to see where it lands?
They said it's evading detection.
It's just New Jersey.
So what's the name of your company?
Right over there.
Okay, so what about White Fox? Are they still around, the guys that...
Yeah, they're doing stuff.
They work with military bases, right? I mean, to figure out how to deploy.
I think they're mostly RF, and they work a lot with like commercial, because they can hack into DJI software and stuff like that.
Right.
And, like, if you break your comms link, or if you have a really encrypted link, then like it's really hard to kind of take over that type of thing.
Because that's what I was hearing on the East Coast. They aren't able to figure out how to communicate with them. And I just kept thinking about this White Fox. Can't they figure out that?
Yeah. Well, there's all sorts of tricks you can do with encryption, frequency hopping. And it's a pretty hard problem to solve. Like, look at Ukraine and Russia. They're,
right.
It's like a cat and mouse game with, frequency and jamming and everything like that. So it's more just the lack of our ability on our side to track them down or shoot them down or legally.
Right.
Do that too. But yeah, it's shows you that like our government needs more tools.
I heard if you shot it down, whoever shoots it down is responsible for whatever happens down on the ground. And I mean, all the people get hurt and all the other things.
Yeah.
I see.
So the liability, if the federal government shot something down and killed other people.
So no drones in your history?
I was before drones. Okay.
How was writing a book? How was the shift from?
Well, I've been talking about this high trust leadership concept for about, I don't know, going on 15 years. So after I met Brian, he helped show me the way, but I just took all the material I'd been speaking on and then consolidated it into the book. So
it was a massive undertaking because he had so much material. That sometimes is the challenge. I'm impressed you were able to finally distill it down into what's been received really well.
Well, I had to get it under 200 pages because I wanted somebody to actually read it.
And it's a lot of bullet points, too.
Yeah, a lot of bullet points. Yeah, that drove Brian crazy.
So how long has the book been out for?
The end of September it came out.
Oh,
So are you doing like speaking tours and things like that?
Brian's signed me up for podcasts, and then I spoke at the
Good Morning
Theater.
Good Morning Slow and in the theater, yeah.
He's
got stuff in the works. He does corporate speaking.
Well, I was going to say, I could totally see that.
Yeah.
Corporate speaking.
You did an event with Chick-fil-A, a big event, and probably going to be doing more with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm just working now to get back in the swing, because I've been speaking as sort of a side gig now for a while, and I just got to get back in the hunt.
Well, you're going to have bandwidth now that you're stepping down.
I'm not doing the COO thing.
The flight Uber driver.
Yeah.
Depends on how much quieter time is required.
That's right.
So what's next for George? Is I know that the speaking is important to you and continuing to empower other leaders. Is there anything else left undone that you hope to do in the next 10 years?
I don't have anything specific in mind, but we just see what comes over the transom, right? Just being open to possibilities. See what's fun. The key thing for me is I want to have control over my time, so that I can do some of these things that that I've been putting off with. You know, because whenever
you're going to Disneyland,
going to Disneyland
within 2 weeks.
That's right.
Finally,
with all the dollars.
That's right.
Anything else before we wrap it up? Because you are going to give us a tour today. Yes.
I have one more question. Any insight as to training or perhaps input with international equivalents, flying?
Yeah, so certainly with all the NATO countries, we do lots of routine training with them. You know, I've done exercises in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, with the French. So lots of big effort for NATO countries to be interoperable, right?
How are they different from the Americans?
Well, I tell you one thing. We did this exercise in the Netherlands, and their military is unionized, so big difference, right? And so every day, we had four F-18s and two F-14s on detachment. We flew off the ship in the Mediterranean, and we flew up to the Netherlands and did this exercise, which was great. They said, they had radio commercials 2 weeks prior that said, okay, in 2 weeks, there's going to be this, you're going to hear loud jet noise and exercise, but it's okay. And then they told us, okay, you can fly anywhere you want, at any altitude you want, except you can't overfly The Hague, and you can't overfly Amsterdam. So we just raged for 2 weeks. But here the poor young technicians trying to fix the airplanes after we'd break them out flying, right? And they'd be on the airplane, working on it, and then the MPs would come and say, okay, base is closing in 5 minutes, you gotta get off. And they'd go, yeah, okay, fine. And they'd be working away, and then they'd come, about the third time, they came with, armed, okay, it's time to get off. It only took the sailors like 2 days to acclimate to that. And then they were ready to get off all the time. So that was the big difference. Also, the fact that they had never deployed out of the country before that, and then they were going to go do a detachment into Bosnia or somewhere during the dust up there in the Adriatic, and they were so excited to go do something. So
all that training.
Yeah.
Have you worked with ACI and all the stuff going on at Hunter Liggett? Because we bring other countries here and do a lot of training.
Yeah, so yeah, we sponsor, host the Royal Air Force twice a year. They come here and they do a month-long detachment. And what they're doing is they're getting parachute calls for their special ops guys. And then what was a C-130 and now is an A-400 aircraft is getting, their pilots are getting trained in those missions as well as what they call expeditionary field operators. There's a dirt airstrip up there, a very short dirt airstrip, and they get to practice landing and taking off from that. So,
you're
really cool.
A lot of the C-130 come in here.
Yep.
As part of those training.
Well, the word's gotten out that if you come here for gas in a C-130 or an Osprey or whatever,
we love it.
You're going to get Firestone tri-tip sandwiches. So it's the little things. So we sell thousands of gallons of gas because these guys come here for the tri-tip.
Blue Angels.
Yeah, you got Fat Albert here.
Yeah, Fat Albert was here the other day. Yeah, yeah. I was out of town, unfortunately. I missed seeing those guys here.
Beautiful pictures with
a couple
of pilots.
Video of it, and I saw Eric's video.
They made quite a buzz.
When I was on my way to a dentist appointment and saw it from Buckley, that it was still here, so I came over, and the crew was just coming in, and someone downstairs asked for a photo, and so I'm like, sure, I'll get one.
Yeah, good.
Well,
good.
I'll say one thing about the book that was surprising to me was the amount of time that he put to acknowledge all of the crew that was serving, because it's like 500, how many people are in the True Blue Angels crew?
100, it's a squadron of 125. Only six of the pilots, that's what people think of the Blue Angels as six demo pilots, but actually it's a team of 125. Most of them are the maintenance personnel and the other support personnel that are needed to pull that all off. For 35 weekends each year.
He pulled together, like, again and again, this list, making sure everybody's
awesome.
Name was correct, you know, like, acknowledging. I don't think that had ever been done before, where someone took take that level of detail to make sure that every single name was accurate, their title, the year, you know, their time served.
Well, the sense of loyalty, I mean, these guys and gals were just unbelievable in their devotion and commitment to doing it right and so forth. And so I just have bottomless gratitude for their support and so forth. And I tell the story sometimes, you know, years ago when Bear Bryant was the football coach at Alabama, and he'd won all these national titles. And so one year he wins the national title, and one of the reporters says to him, "So Bear, is this the best team you ever had? Is this a great team?" And he says, "Well, too early to tell. See me in 20 years, I'll let you know." Right? And my team still gets together every year. Not everybody all the time, but you know, we typically get 40 or 50, 60 people together every year.
It's a reunion.
Just, it's really cool. Yeah.
And so it takes 25 people to put one pilot in a seat.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah,
well, you just get to walk to the plane and step in your plane. It's all been pre-checked. And
that was the only time that I didn't, in my 40 years of flying, that I didn't pre-flight the airplane that I was going to get in and go fly. That's trust. My crew chief, he made sure that it was ready to go. And when he signed the sheet that says the airplane's ready to go, I completely trusted him. So when we did the show, you walk out, march down, and climb in, and off you go, and you're flying the heck out of those airplanes, but the relationship between you and your crew chief is just magical. Yeah.
Is your crew chief also a pilot?
No. He's an enlisted technician. But every day, you know, one of the things you might imagine is the system is designed to help the pilots avoid a distraction. You want to be able to, and the whole routine of from the time that you leave the hotel to go out to the airport to get into the to get there, park the cars, get into the meeting room, then sit down at the table. Everything is designed to get the pilots to the point that when you get in the cockpit, there is no distraction, right? So when I'd sit down every day to go fly, I'd climb in, and every switch was exactly the same place. My gloves were in the same place. The helmet was ready. Everything was the same, so that there was no distraction as best you could do that.
When you get out, you debrief every single time?
Yeah, that is a sacred ritual that we had, is that after every flight but one, we would have a debrief, whether it was in training, two or three flights a day, or whether at an air, you know, doing the air show. But everything else could wait until we sat down and figured out what happened, why did it happen, good and bad, and what can we learn from this and then apply tomorrow so that we can keep getting better and better and better every day. And the routine for that was only the people involved in the flight could be in the room. And that was not just the pilots, but the maintenance officer and the flight surgeon. Everybody had a role to play in the show or in the practice. And so those people were in the room. but no friends, no family, because you didn't want anybody holding back because, who's that guy over there? I don't know. You know, I'm not gonna, because we wanted everybody to be completely honest. It was literally you'd take off the rank when you walked into the room and you came in as teammates, and because we wanted everybody to contribute, right? And I would start the debrief as the leader, and to set the example, I would share with my team any significant mistakes I was aware of that I made, which at the beginning, when you're learning, it's a lot, but then as you go on, of course, it becomes less and less, thankfully. But that did a couple things. It gave my wingmen and the other people in the room a sense of my awareness of my own performance, because if I'm making a mistake and I don't know it, we got a problem. If I got a mistake and I'm not willing to admit it, we got another problem, because who wants to trust somebody who won't admit to their own mistakes, right? And what that did was that sent a message to the team that, okay, we're all learning here, we're all trying to get better, and we're human. So mistakes are gonna happen. But as long as it's not negligence, as long as you're trying as hard as you can and prepared and doing the best you can, and you own it and commit yourself to get better, then you know that's all part of it. And so then the number two pilot, number three, number four, we just go around the room and everybody would do the same. And then at the end of each of our comments, to remind us of what a privilege it was to be part of an elite organization like that and who we're representing. And we would all end our comments with the same words, "I'm glad to be here." Mm-hmm. And just saying those words, no matter how bad a day you had, helped you, you know, hang in there. And then when you hear the other people in the room that you're with, they each say those simple words, it's contagious, you know, and little things like that make a big difference. And that's one of the things as I work with corporate groups and organizations, that's a real deficiency in the organizations that I see, that they don't feel they have the time or the need to sit down after a significant event and figure out, okay, what happened here? What can we learn from this? They're just moving too fast, got too many things going on.
Brian asked earlier about the difference between military and civilian, and you're sitting there as a pilot giving life and death trust to 25 people. I don't see many business leaders stepping up and doing that.
Well,
it's different than the absolute authority thing. I mean, it's an absolute faith.
Yeah. And I tell people, look, for us, we in the trust continuum of very low trust to unconditional trust, we had to be here, no matter, because otherwise, at best, it was going to be mission failure, and at worst, it was going to be a fireball, right? So we had to be here. The organizations I talk to, they don't need to be here, but if they would just get here, the difference that would make would be profound.
Well, just to back it up, you had mentioned about debriefing only once that you didn't. Was it one event or one type of flight?
One flight. We did not debrief, and that was the last flight of the year. Mm. Because the team changes. So when you see the team fly, it's a two-year assignment to be a pilot. So when you see them fly, recognize that three of the pilots are in their first year and three are in their second year. So after the last show, literally, your name, if you've been there now 2 years and you're leaving, when you get done with that show, your name is off your parking spot, it's off your locker, the new name is up, you know, okay, get going.
Now you're a chum.
It's off the airplane.
That's right. They changed the name on the airplane. So that team is not going to fly together again. So now that doesn't mean we didn't go back and look at the videotape, because that, see how we did, but that's the one show we don't.
Well, I tell you, it's still hard to hear George talk about himself, but I do think it's because he lives this service above self. So everything I've been trying to pull from him, because they want 50% of the art to be about you and your family and your personal life, and 50% to be about, you know, your mission and your book and all that. But I get it, because you really don't spend a lot of time on yourself when you're outwardly focused in what you can do, and you left to kind of what your dad instilled in you, which was,
right,
you know, making the biggest impact you can while you still can.
Right.
So with that, I think we're going to wrap it up. Maybe on your tombstone, or what I learned today was train hard, fight easy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually really nice when you walk into something prepared, because you're a lot cooler under pressure. And I mean, there's something to be said for throwing your hat over the fence and having to go get it, but it's much easier if you're prepared and you're that's maybe where confidence comes
from. That's right.
Because confidence is not one of the C's.
No.
But it's an important.
Yeah. I mean, I think it falls under competency, right? You have to, because we would say, you know, everything was built on repetition to get better, get better, get better, get better. Mm-hmm. And so our motto was, you know, we're going to keep doing it until we get it right, and then we're going to keep doing it until we can't get it wrong. Just the basics over and over and over again.
Did you reach that ultimate pinnacle in the Blue Angels past? Isn't there like a certain amount of space that not all Blue Angels achieve?
Most teams get there by, you know, as you get near towards the end of the season, right? I mean, if you saw a Blue Angel air show with their first show down in El Centro, where they're doing their winter training, they do the first show there before they leave and start the circuit. And if you saw a Blue Angel show there on March 15th, their first show, you would see a Blue Angel air show. It would be very, very cool. But then you see them up in San Francisco in late September, early October, near the end of the season, and you had a discerning eye, you would notice that they were flying closer together, they're flying lower, and the show is shorter because they're being more aggressive in coming back around to get set up for the next maneuver. So each week, just trying to get a little better and a little better and a little better. Yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you for listening to this awesome podcast. We'll have someone new for the next episode. It'll be hard to match George, but we'll try. And with that, we'll go ahead and sign off.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by Softech. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit Softech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.